Welcome to the Mentoris Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorisproject.org. Our guest today is Adam Parker, the author of The Judicious Use of Intangibles, a novel based on the life of Pietro Belluschi, an Italian architect and leader of the modern movement in architecture. He worked largely in the U.S. in response to the rise of Benito Mussolini. Belluschi designed over 1,000 buildings in a career that culminated in his becoming the Dean of Architecture at MIT, better known as the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Thanks for joining us today, Adam.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We're always excited to talk about new stories, new authors, and new Italians who affected the world in interesting ways. So my first question is always, why does Belluschi matter to us today?
Well, you know, he matters because he's somebody who is sort of the workhorse of 20th century architecture. Ask the average person to name an architect, and you may get lucky. I would have been lucky starting this project to have named five people, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright, Frank Gehry, Zaha Hadid, maybe Philip Johnson because I really love his glass house, or Le Corbusier because I went to a college that had a building, his only building in North America, which it was a big deal for the university. You know, that's the only five that I could have named off the top of my head. Pietro Belluschi, you know, was somebody who was doing thousands of buildings. Pietro Belluschi differentiated himself because he wasn't just looking to design a building that everyone would ooh and ah at. He was designing buildings that would fulfill a function for the people who would use them, and designed thousands of buildings, including ones that if you go through his list of buildings, you may find that you have actually been inside one that you didn't even know. I know for me, living in Boston for a while, I'd been to the Back Bay Convention Center, the Chestnut Hill Shopping Center, which he was an advisor to, and I also opened up a banking account at one of the buildings he designed. So his buildings are all around us.
That's beautiful. And we don't really recognize the everyday things we do and who's behind them.
Exactly.
I think that's beautiful. So I like to figure out how people's childhoods influenced their careers and the things they chose to do in their career. So what do you think about his childhood?
His childhood was definitely affected by his time growing up in sort of like the rural coastal town of Ancona, Italy. Sort of an out-of-the-way town. And then when he was about 6 years old, his family moved to Rome, the big city. His father worked for the railroad, which his grandfather worked for before him. And it was sort of his introduction to this melting pot of culture and society and history. And then later on, he kind of got his big shot to get out of Italy and strike his own bit of history when the Countess Irene de Roblant gave him a scholarship to go to Cornell and study for a year.
So fascinating to think that even then, Cornell considered a place to be, as opposed to somewhere in Europe.
Yes, very much so. And it's definitely something that I connected with on his journey as well, because he was given this opportunity sort of out of the blue, similar to, you know, my own experience growing up, sort of getting an opportunity out of the blue to be a summer exchange student in Japan. So I definitely got to share in his fish out of water, going into a culture that he didn't really understand at the time, because he went to Cornell and didn't even speak English at the time.
And yet managed to get a degree.
And then decided to stay in America, continue working on his English, continue his study of architecture.
What relationship in his life do you think really fueled his desires? Are we talking about parents, girlfriends, people he met here in the States?
Probably it was his relationship with himself. One thing that really inspired my take on the novel was how focused he was from an early age on his legacy. From an early age, he would be on the lookout for someone to write his memoirs, something that continued on later in his life, and actually had a few times where people started working on telling his story, and then it didn't really work out.
Interesting. And sometimes you have to be that interior focused, I guess, to have the achievements he had.
Exactly.
Interesting. So you didn't know anything about him before you started. What did you think about architecture as an art?
I was definitely someone who was inspired and interested in architecture, in the way that we interact with it, in the way that it can affect our ability to connect with the world. I had the wonderful opportunity to visit a number of his buildings, my favorite of which to visit was probably Juilliard, a building which he partnered with Eduardo Catalano on. It was at a period where Juilliard had worked with a number of architects to submit designs, but they didn't like any of the designs that people had submitted. So they came to Pietro and asked him what he'd do, and he said, you know, how would I know what the design should be unless I know how it'll be used? So he spoke to students, he spoke to teachers, and he asked them questions like, when are your classes? How much time do you have between rehearsals? How much do you practice a day? How can you sleep with all of the practicing that you're doing? And it painted a picture of the students, you know, waking up early in the morning, doing their own warm-ups, sometimes for hours at a time. And then they'd hop around all day from class to class, from ensemble to ensemble, all the while trying to find space for solo practice in between. So he designed this intricate system of organically interconnected spaces. When I toured it, it sort of felt like this beehive, which really matched the beehive of activity that he was trying to contain. And it really matched this harmony that he had between individual practice spaces tucked in between ensemble spaces, not, you know, removing them far away somewhere else. And I was, you know, very lucky to be able to tour it because they usually only allow prospective students at Juilliard to tour the space. But oddly enough, my mother, who teaches elementary music at a small school in rural Montana, randomly knows the president of Juilliard. So she was able to reach out to him because they worked out a music education project years ago, and I was able to go on a tour with prospective students.
That's an excellent piece of research and a lovely connection to make happen. But I love that description of it as a beehive. You can visualize it. Mm-hmm. That's so beautiful. So I'm guessing that's one of your favorite research things that you discovered, but what else did you discover about his life or some fascinating piece of his work that really stuck with you?
The piece that was the most emotional for me and most interesting was something that was a footnote in one of the nonfiction books about him. In the big long list of all the different buildings that he designed was a little footnote about him designing a Japanese relocation center in Portland, which, given the historical context, in a little bit more research, I was able to figure out that basically he helped redesign a livestock facility that was reconfigured for humans reconfigured for humans as a temporary holding facility for Japanese Americans before they were sent to internment camps. And he did this at a time where he was designing his equitable office building. It was under construction. And this was kind of his launch pad into the international ranks of well-known architects. It was this building, the first of its kind, basically the prototype of the glass and aluminum skyscraper that we know today and then see everywhere. And it was this idea of designing equitably for all mankind, a vision of what mankind is capable of, all while at the same time contributing to the internship of Japanese Americans during the war. So I saw that, and then doing research in nonfiction books, going to, you know, reading speeches he read, seeing some videos from him at the time to study his manner of speech, built a big, long timeline of everything that he did in his professional and personal life and the people he worked with, and saw that, especially later in his life, he really had a focus on working with Japanese-American artists on projects later on in his life. So for me, in particular, my favorite scene to write was one involving the master carpenter George Nakashima. It was at this time where Pietro was going from Portland on the East Coast to becoming the dean of the MIT School of Architecture. He gets his big first commission on the East Coast. The Portsmouth Abbey School, this private Benedictine boys' school in rural Rhode Island. And, you know, they've already fired the previous architect, so he knows he has to come in there and dazzle them. And if they don't like his design, they're just going to go and replace him with someone else. So he approaches this master carpenter, George Nakashima. He's one of the most sought-after artists on the East Coast. And Pietro wants him to design the altar, some altar furniture in the pews, so that he can include it in his design for the abbey in order to wow the fathers at the abbey. The trick to the situation, though, is that at this time, George Nakashima is so sought after that he only takes on new clients who travel in person to his workshop in Pennsylvania. And not only that, but he says that you must become his friend in order to then become his business associate. So Pietro needs this meeting to go really well. And he goes and they start drinking tea, you know, having bits of small talk. And Pietro inquires about, you know, where did George learn his carpentry skills? And he learns that George studied, and this is true, with the master carpenter Gentaro Hikigawa in Idaho. And Pietro's like, wait, you learned this in Idaho? I didn't know there were any Japanese master carpenters in Idaho. Mm. And George says, well, I learned it while I was at Camp Minidoka, the internment camp in Idaho. And not only that, but he went there with him and his parents and his wife Marion and his little girl Mira, who was only 6 weeks old at the time. And they all had to stay at the Portland Relocation Center Pietro designed before being sent to the internment camp. So Pietro is in the position of really needing George's help, but he had a hand in one of his most horrible experiences of George's life. So as soon as Pietro learns about this, he drops the teacup he was holding and it shatters on the ground. And in that moment, George Nakashima shows him an enormous amount of grace. Because, and this is true, it was at the internment camp where George Nakashima got paired with master carpenter Gentaro Hikigawa to build furniture. You know, they put them together to make the barracks that everyone was staying in more hospitable, more like home, because they didn't know how long they were going to stay there. So that's where he learned carpentry, and it's the skill that helped him rebuild his life after being sent to the internment camps. And it's the reason that Pietro is in front of him asking for his help now. In that moment, George tells him something that Hikigawa Sensei taught him, which is that every tree, every piece of wood, everything deserves a second chance. And that's the reason why George agrees to work with Pietro, because he's learned how to take things that are broken and make them beautiful.
That is beautiful. And it's beautiful. You couldn't make that up.
Well, I sort of did.
Yeah, well, some.
It's like he definitely like designed this relocation center. Right. George definitely went there, was processed through there, and then they later worked on together. What I had to fill in for much of this novel was the personal side to his life that wasn't in the nonfiction books.
Of course, but it makes perfect sense that someone would have wanted trust and honor, and that would be part of their conversation.
Right, exactly. Especially since, and I definitely wanted to focus on moments like that and bring it up, because especially since Pietro was so focused on how he would be perceived in posterity.
That's very true. That is an interesting part of it. But you couldn't have made up that they were connected in that fashion. That's quite beautiful. I love it. From a writing standpoint, what sort of themes did you see running through his life?
Definitely the search for purpose, the search for legacy, and that's why I introduced this device in the narrative where he interacts with the story of Amadeus and Salieri. First is the Rimsky-Korsakov opera, then the Peter Schaeffer play, then the movie Amadeus, so that he can externalize this search for how history would perceive him.
So you injected the movie, not clear on whether he'd actually seen it.
Oh, he saw it. It would have been possible for him to see it because he died after 1984 when the movie came out. And his sister, when he was young, was an opera singer. So I put his sister as being in the opera that he would have seen that was then adapted later on.
Brilliant, brilliant piece of work. I love that. I love that. Excellent. Well, then, we always like to ask, did he have any mentors? And did he mentor other people in his career?
Very much so. as the head of an architecture firm and then later as the dean of the MIT School of Architecture, you know, it was literally his job to mentor hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And he had a lot of people like him coming up, like Eddie, A.E. Doyle, who ran the first architecture firm that he was at, Charles Green, who ran the design department there, who then introduced him to classes with Harry Wentz at the Portland Art Museum, who really got him thinking about designing artistically and holistically, how to approach architecture as an art for humans to interact with, and it really influenced his design philosophy, which he loosely referred to as, you know, the title of this novel, The Judicious Use of Intangibles, those intangibles being space, light, texture, and color. And it's really with Harry Wentz where he really focused on how to balance those things in design and got him to the point where, after taking classes at the Portland Art Museum, he actually got his one of his first big breaks designing a new wing for the Portland Art Museum. And his design was so good that Frank Lloyd Wright himself spoke to the board of the museum and said, hey, you need to give a shot to this up-and-coming architect. His design is the best that you can do, and you need to take his design.
That's the ultimate mentorship that someone of Frank Lloyd Wright's level could provide.
Exactly. And Pietro definitely got to pay him back later in life when Frank Lloyd Wright was up for the American Institute of Architects Gold Medal. It was later in Frank Lloyd Wright's life. He had mainly done residential architecture. The Institute wasn't going to give him a gold medal because they didn't necessarily see him in the pantheon that we recognize him as today. And Pietro definitely led a group of young guns to get them to recognize him and give him that honor.
Isn't that interesting? And when you talked about when we could name five of our own architects, just off the top of our head, we all think of him first.
Right. He's number one for most people. But in his time, he wasn't necessarily as well regarded just because he hadn't done the breadth of buildings. You know, whereas someone like Pietro, especially later in his life, had done residential architecture, office buildings, churches, such a wide variety of things. And Frank Lloyd Wright was known mainly for his houses.
Then it's beautiful that your novel gives us a chance to know Pietro in a way that we assume we all know Frank Lloyd Wright.
Exactly.
That's a perfect place to end, except that we always like to ask people now, of course, who would you say mentored you in life?
I would definitely list my high school English teacher, John Roberts. I also had a number of Pietro Belluschi-esque mentors in college, but I would also like to do a special shout out to the novelist Tommy Orange and his novel There, There, who really, in a conceptual way, influenced the strategy of using the Amadeus Salieri story that I do here, incorporating that. So that's more of a academic, conceptual, theoretical one, but I definitely want to give credit where credit is due.
I think that's only fair because we do learn from all the different things we read and the styles we take in, whether that's screenwriting, whether that's novel writing. We're learning those things from that kind of research. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.